Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome you to today's luncheon and opportunity to get an update on our weather and market economic conditions as we go through the rest of 2013. We'll start out today with Dr. Elwin Taylor, professor at Iowa State University Extension and the Extension climatologist. I look forward to his presentations each and every year, although I would have to say, and I've told him this, that I'm a little disappointed that this time a year ago, I remember being in here and he answered a question specifically about what are our opportunities for a drought last year, and he said less than 50%. And I think from that week, officially here in Iowa, just about exactly, Dr. Taylor, with your presentation, from that date forward, I'm not sure we saw any more water here in the state for the most part. So whether you were trying to actually prove that sometimes less than 50% comes true, I don't know, but it certainly was a bellwether moment last year at Expo, and it really changed as we went through the rest of the summer. But we're pleased to have you here again today. He's going to present, going to be able to take a few questions, and let's hope that you have some better news for us as we go forward through the rest of this summer. So join me now in welcoming Dr. Taylor.
Thank you very much, Bill. Somebody said, will we be able to stay awake for this presentation? I said, there's a 50% chance. Lots of things going on with the weather. And, of course, everyone concerned about it, whether they're producing grain or whether they're buying grain. Important to pay attention to these kind of things. My outlook that I put out most recently for the national corn yield is 147 bushels to the acre for corn. That's considerably above last year's yield. Just to summarize everything that I'm going to talk about today, 147 is considerably better than 123 for last year's corn yield for the U.S. and considerably below the trend line, which is 160. I really just expected it to be between those two numbers, so I put it there. And that's about as good a calculation as we've got on that number this year, except that the market kind of goes with it. What we are seeing is extremes of weather. Here you see a child on a farm up near Waterloo, Iowa, in 8 inches of snow, and 2 days later with the chickens on the grass in the same spot. It was really quite a dramatic month that we had in May. In May, we broke the record for the most snow in May this year in Iowa. The old record was set in 1947, the May then. We also, of course, just 2 weeks later, had 100-degree weather in the western half of the state and a lot of places over 100 degrees. That was a new record for May, and it broke the records that we had back in 47. We had a flood in western Iowa, Cherokee area in this case, the Little Sioux River in that area, and it set a new record high flood on the 24th of May, breaking the record that was set on the 17th of May, 1947. Seems like I'm mentioning 1947 quite a bit. This is a year that we're in right now with the volatility of weather that we had seen back in 47. Every year, people ask me, what is the year this one is most like? As if that would make any difference to what the weather was going to turn out for the year. But people like to know that. So I always look through all of the weather records and see what year was most like this one. And this year that we're having, and we start counting the new year on October the 1st, by the way, because after October the 1st, crops aren't using water. Trees, even with leaves, aren't using very much water. Lawns, still green, aren't using very much water. The precipitation that falls after the 1st of October goes toward next year's moisture in the soil. So we start the water year on October the 1st. That's New Year's Day, if you're a climatologist or a hydrologist. One person accused us of being party-oriented people in our vocation, two New Year's Eves every year. I'm mentioning these things, however, because of the importance of managing risk. Risk in agriculture is a significant thing. We need to manage it for a couple of reasons. One, of course, for our own good, but also for everyone else's good. The most important industry on earth, agriculture. The largest industry on earth, agriculture. The oldest industry on earth, agriculture. So important. Food so important. Trade so important to nations. We would like to think that even if there's a rough year, the farms will still be in business next year. And we won't have such a disaster that it's got a many year down the road before there's a recovery. So risk management becomes a priority, not just for us as individuals, but for our nations, that we have a risk management. This is the age of risk management. The thing to remember about risk, risk has numbers. And we can manage anything with numbers. If we know the chance of it being 2 is twice as great as the chance of being 4, we know something we can do about it by knowing the numbers. A lot of times people mix up uncertainty with risk. Uncertainty, however, has no numbers. It's uncertain. As soon as you get a number on it, then it becomes risk. And risk is manageable. If someone tells you there's a risk of having a flood in the next week because of what our river's doing, you say, what is that risk? They'll say, well, having a flood. You say, no, the numbers. How bad of a flood and what's the chance of it occurring? Then you can manage it. If it's a 99% chance of having a flood that's less than 1 inch over the banks, maybe you don't care. If it's a 20% chance of having a flood that's 20 feet over the banks of the river, you care a great deal. And you make different management decisions. A lot of us manage our finances for our agricultural industry we're involved in with just money. Others are interested in the production. I'll plant a different hybrid. I'll treat my soil in a different way to manage the risk that we're facing this coming year, for example. But all of this, risk has numbers, we're paying more attention to it, and we should. And the practice that you've been doing with risk during the past 10 years, from the way things look, at least to me, for the next 25 years, your risk management practice of the last 10 years has been just that, practice for what is needed now. And I'll point that out. We're headed for some years with very good crops, some years with very bad crops. Well, doesn't that always happen? No, it doesn't always happen. But let's talk a little bit about corn. A curious plant, an annual plant. As far as the corn plant itself is concerned, it reproduces by seed. It doesn't live till next year, no matter what. And if it doesn't have viable seed, that plant, if it could think, would say, I'll be extinct if I don't have viable seed produced. Here's a corn plant that was under really terrible conditions last year. And you peel back the husk on the corn, and you see about 3 good kernels and all the rest of them aborted. Corn does that. It will put all of its effort into getting at least one viable seed. If it's got, doesn't need so much effort because things are better, it will have 16 rows of 40 kernels per row. But as times get tougher, it will drop things off trying to get at least one viable seed. This is an important thing about corn. As soon as it is pollinated, that plant loses all interest in doing anything except producing something viable, it loses interest in growing new roots. Rule of thumb, after silking, corn does not grow new roots. Effect on wet years in the spring, we get poor root systems, and they never recover from being poor. Because by the time the wet has gone away and the excess moisture's out of the soil, so the roots could go down the normal of 5 feet, they won't. Because the plant is beyond the stage of growing roots actively. And many farmers have said, all of my lifetime, at least that I've heard things, a lot of times it's the dusty springs when we're a little bit short on water that we get the best crops, as we get the deepest roots. And it's the wet springs with the shallow roots that often turn out bad, like it did in 47 and 77 and 83. And you start to name the years that started off wet, poor root systems, and when it turned warm and dry, we had essentially crop failure. That wouldn't have been a failure, perhaps, if we would have had a situation of deeper roots to start with. So it aggravates the situation a bit. The USDA keeps records of yield. When you hear of a trend yield from the USDA, they're always talking about the best straight line through 30 years of record. 30 years of record on the screen for U.S. corn yield. The first third or half of the graph shows a lot of variability of corn yield in the U.S., ups and downs compared to the right-hand side of the graph. The right-hand side of the graph is more consistent. There are periods of time in our climate when we have high variability of weather causes high variability of yields. And there are the consistent times. Those show up on the right side of the graph in this case. I've drawn a little box, a little rectangle, around 6 years from 2004 through 2009. Six consecutive years of above trend line yield. That's the first time this has happened since we started keeping records of corn yield in the U.S. back in the 1860s. First time we've had six consecutive years of above trend yield. Some people are starting to think that's the great plant breeding. Well, the reason we got this uptrend is mostly great plant breeding. That's a logical thing to think. But this 6 years above trend, we're going to have new trends. We've changed the trend. Thank you, plant breeders. Except that talk went away. 2010, we had a slightly below trend yield for corn in the U.S. 11, considerably below. 12, disastrously below. Well, maybe it was just the weather. And the plant breeding, as good as it is, it's just got something to do with the trend that we've been seeing all along, which it does, of course. Why is U.S. corn production up? Corn has become profitable. That's the first reason. I can't think of a second reason. Production is up. I gave the keynote speech for the World Rice Conference last year. That was a question that they wanted to know. Why is the U.S. so down in rice production? Upsetting the whole world's rice trade. And I said, because corn production is up and has taken over some rice land and some cotton land because corn has become profitable. Well, hasn't corn always been profitable? I had a question asked me about 4 years ago by an elderly person. Elwin, I don't think we were any better off with our 200 bushel corn this year, that was 4 years ago, than we were back in 1950 with our 40 bushel corn. I said, no, we're not. Why is that? I said, because you're such a good guy. What? Back in 1950, you sold your 40 bushels of corn for just what it cost you to grow it. And this year, you sold your 200 bushels for just what it cost you to grow it. And you don't make any more money by giving away your corn for no profit now than you did back in 1950. What makes you think that?
Well, I don't know for sure that you did.
I just know what Iowa as a whole did. I've seen a graph from a friend of mine who's an economist and knows this kind of thing. And he said, I'll give you a blue line, and that's how much corn was selling for on the average in Iowa each year. And a red line, that's how much it costs to produce a bushel of corn. And the past 3 years, we've been above the cost of production on selling corn. It's been profitable. And on the very right of this picture, you see his estimate of what it will be this year. Still profitable. Yeah, but some years, the red line's above the blue. In fact, quite a few years when people were selling their corn for less than the cost of production and sometimes for more than the cost of production. Where you see the vertical red lines is where we had reduced yield because of weather, typically drought years or flood years. And so you have all the fixed cost producing corn and the yield's down, so the cost per bushel for you is up. But usually the price didn't go up as much as the cost of production went up with the drought, and so those were some bad years. And overall, you can't tell from the graph if people make money on corn or lose money on corn or if it's a break even. Comes within a nickel if you add up all the numbers. And of course you can't tell. The most important industry on earth, the biggest industry on earth, the only industry on earth I know of that sells what it produces for the cost of producing it. Doesn't need to be that way, I guess. Someday, maybe, farmers will say, we're a good industry, we ought to make money, like other industries do. Maybe not. Maybe we'll be happy to be paid for our labor to grow the crop rather than paid a profit. Well, that's the point on the thing anyway. Now, the price of corn varies with both supply and demand, I learned in the fourth grade. And I suppose that that's true. But there's a change in crop demand. Now, corn can be used for food, among other things, either food for humans or for livestock. And if you get more people on the earth, an increase in population, you will have an increase in demand for food, whatever the food crop is. Not necessarily an increase in demand, however, for food for animals. When the population of people becomes more wealthy, then you get an increase in demand for food for animals, because a wealthier people eat animals and other animal products, whereas people that are just a larger population, no increase in wealth, will tend to consume plants. Food, the corn and other things are used for food and fiber. I don't know how fiber demand varies with the population and the wealth of the population, so I left that with just a question mark. And for energy, biofuel, one of the direct things of energy. And the fuel demand goes up very quickly with wealth. People get more money, they want to spend it on something that uses energy. It goes up a bit with the population as well. And as we switch from where our fuel comes from, does it come from fossils or from bio sources, from hydro sources, in other words, water-generated electricity or something, that will also change the demand. One person said in my hearing, we've never had to deal with anything like sharing our food supply for fuel before. And I thought, maybe you haven't, but I did. When I was 10 and 11 years old, we still farmed with horses. Back in 1950, the poor people still farmed with horses. Poor people still had horses then. Today it's different. It's the rich people that have the horses. But we still had horses. And the horses I call biofuel power equipment. The horses took one-third of our farm to feed. And then the horses powered our farm equipment. And I checked as best I could check in the literature, and that's about what it was for everybody. It took about one-third of the land to power the equipment that operates the land for farming in the U.S. and in other places. And curiously, the amount of biofuel that's calculated to be needed for what people think we need to keep our trade balanced and our dependence on fuel and our climate change under control will require about one-third of our farmland. That's a competition for the land, for fuel, or for food. About one-third, the way it was back before the Second War. So we pretty much know what things would be like there. Here's the data on this. If you look at the lower left corner of this chart, there's a word there that mentions a nation, Ethiopia. And the energy consumption per capita goes high to low, just about as low as, probably the lowest we know of any country is per person, is Ethiopia. Do they have a lot of money or very little? Almost none per person. Country with almost no money per person, almost no energy consumption per person. You give somebody more money, they'll spend it on something that consumes more energy. Give them $1,000 more money, and my wife said, I want something to wash the clothes better. And she didn't have in mind a scrubbing board like Grandma used. She had in mind something that used power to wash the clothes around our house or the dishes. And so as we get more money, we spend it on something that uses more energy. It was in 1966 I went to a seminar with quite a famous climatologist, Dr. Hiram Johnson. And he said, the problem we've got in this world is not the climate change. It's not the global temperature change. The problem is our hunger for energy. All the years since 1966 have proven that Dr. Johnson was exactly right. Here we are in the United States, number 5 in the world in how much money we have per person, number 8 in the world in how much energy we use per person. But everybody's pretty much in the same boat. More available money, more energy consumption. So we're energy hungry. And this has caused some problems in the world. And it gets us to the point of biofuel. Why do we have biofuel? Number one, we have it because we like energy. Our hunger for energy can influence the climate. The influence that it's had on the climate is when we burn fossils, which we do to get most of our energy, faster than the Earth creates fossils, it's going to increase the carbon in the air. There's no way around that. That's what's going to happen. And the carbon in the air has gone up. Since I was in high school, it's gone from 312 to 386. And the big reason for that is we're burning fossils faster than the Earth creates new fossils. But if we use bioenergy, this approach is a totally renewable fuel. That is something that when we burn it, it puts carbon in the air, and when the thing that we burned grows some new for next year, it takes that carbon back out of the air. And so a biofuel that's a true biofuel would not have the problem of increasing carbon dioxide in the air that you hear so much about in the news these days. But bioenergy is also a food-fuel trade-off. And that worries some people, of course. This is the graph of how the carbon dioxide's gone up since 1958 when we started measuring it up to the present time. It goes up and down every year because plants grow in the temperate time of year, and we burn a lot of fuel in the cold time of year, but overall it's up because we're consuming fossils faster than the earth makes new ones. I want to talk about precipitation in the Midwest. Now that we're talking about production of grain, since precipitation is so important to it. Precipitation in the Midwest has a cyclic nature. In fact, it's a multi-cyclic nature, more than one cycle going on in the precipitation. It cycles by through the year. June is usually the wettest month in Iowa, and sometimes it's July, but usually it's June. That's the annual cycle. We have a 10-year cycle. We have a 60-year cycle. It's multi-cyclic. And this thing that you hear about in the news called climate change may be having an effect here also, in that the Midwest as a whole receives 10% more annual precipitation now than we did back in the 50s. A curious thing that happens with that, it was back in the 50s when people said, we ought to know what a 10-year flood is, a 20-year flood, a 50-year flood, a 100-year flood, so we can manage risk of floods. And they calculated what a 100-year flood was from the amount of precipitation we got every year on the average back in the 50s and before. And it was right. And now we get 10% more. And 10% more precipitation causes double the amount of water to go down the rivers. Because the crops used to use just about all the water that fell, and the extra is what was going down the stream. 10% more precipitation in Iowa doubles the water in the stream because the crops didn't need that extra moisture. 10% more water going down every stream in the state of Iowa and Illinois and South Dakota and Indiana puts the rivers over their banks. Not just twice as often when we put twice as much moisture down them. Puts them over the banks 6 times as often. And suddenly a 100-year flood is expected every 17 years. So that is in keeping with the long-term climate change that we hear so much about in the news that could be the thing that's causing us to have this 10% more moisture now than we used to have. And 100-year floods to be now coming every 17 years. Which, the last 100-year flood was only 15 years. But that 17 is the estimate. And we are always thinking between 93 and 2008, for example, and the flood periods that we've been having. We have some dry times. Here are the 3 driest years in central Iowa since 1950. All 3 dry years were the same dry. We had only 20 inches of moisture for the year. And all of the other years were wetter than that. And you can see on this chart the trend that is up, that 10% since 1950. But I want you to notice where those 3 red arrows are. It was kind of a below normal year, at least not a wet year, the year before the dry year and the year after. And if we look at the 3 before 1950, they look the same. So we know that a year as dry as last year is a multi-year impact situation, not just a one-time event like the minor ones that you see elsewhere in the chart. There are 2 kinds of drought that we've noticed in this world, and we've put drought into 2 categories for at least 3,000 years. If you've read the Old Bible, in the book of Amos, for example, you'll hear about a drought of hunger for food, and a drought, thirst for water. 2 kinds. Later that became known as agricultural drought and hydrologic drought. The water going down the streams, the water in the lakes, the water available to the cities, and the water that the crops were needing. And so we have 2 kinds of drought. They show up on the drought monitor. Here's today's issue of the National Drought Monitor. The National Drought Monitor has some letter L marks on it in western Minnesota and in District 1 of Iowa. That means long-term drought. The rivers are still low in the area. The lakes are low. The water supply in the wells is diminished. And some places have an S. That's a short-term drought. There's probably still plenty of water in the wells and in the lakes, but the soil is shy for the needs of the crops. So short-term and long-term. Usually short-term comes first. Until the short-term's completely corrected, the long-term seldom begins to correct. The situation of drought. We still have a continuation of the drought that's been around now. This is into its fourth year. 3 years in the U.S. of below trend crop yield, and likely we're into the fourth now. Not as bad as last year, but not as good as trend. But the Corn Belt, it's only the extreme western Corn Belt that still has the drought in the soil and in the long term at the present time. But it will still likely have some effect. This drought was associated with the second strongest La Nina in recorded history. We hear about El Nino and La Nina. El Nino, pretty much the friend of the Midwest farmer. La Nina, not the friend of the Midwest farmer. And this La Nina showed up, and with the La Nina, yes, the winter might be wet in the Ohio River Valley, but everything south of that, dry, and some places dry and warm for the winter. And some places, like in Canada and Montana, Washington State, the winter will be wetter than usual and colder than usual. It was an interesting thing. For those 6 years of above-trend yield in the U.S. Corn Belt, the people in western Canada and bordering on Montana were beginning to think they were in a climate change drought that might prevent them from even growing wheat in the near future. 6 years of wheat drought, while we had 6 years of corn plenty. And then came the La Nina. And we went to drought, beginning in Texas and New Mexico and the Carolinas. And then it spread to other places. And in Canada, they went from 6 years of drought to wet conditions. Argentina, by the way, responds to El Nino, La Nina about the same way as the U.S. Corn Belt. So the La Nina, corn is at risk. Wheat crops are usually, especially those in the West and up in Canada, are usually good. So they usually go the opposite of what corn is doing. And this being the response to El Nino and La Nina, basically for at least these two of the four very important agricultural grain crops, corn and wheat, and especially in this hemisphere. El Nino for the U.S., the friend of U.S. production, and La Nina, not the friend of production, with Canada just the other way around. We keep track of what's going on by the air pressure. And when the air pressure says the SOI, which is our abbreviation for air pressure, up in the red area, here we were at the second strongest La Nina, strongest one was in the mid-50s, and it changes where the high and low pressures are in most of the earth and brings drought our way. In this case, it went away, but it took a while for the weather to get back to normal about there. And right now, we didn't switch from La Nina to El Nino, as most of us assumed we would. There was about a 60 or 70% chance of going there and about a 30% chance of it coming back up to here. And it looks right now, here's the day before yesterday's value, that we're headed right back up toward La Nina, which would be just about as bad as we can imagine for the Corn Belt having started off with a wet spring. That flood that came right after the 6 years of drought in Canada and Washington and Montana washed out their transcontinental highway, the Canadian Highway 1. Here's the flood area. That flood, of course, had to drain somewhere. It came down the Missouri River, and as we were going into drought, was bringing floods along the Missouri River, western Iowa, and the people in that vicinity. Right now, there's floods in Europe. This farmer's probably distressed. These are the worst floods in Europe, at least in many parts of Europe, covering the red areas, of 500 years, 501 years, actually. So, having disastrous floods there. This will have a world impact, of course, on grains and other agricultural things. Well, here we are, perhaps going back into a La Nina. Even without going into a La Nina, I had still made my estimate of yield for this year to be at 147, somewhere between where it was last year, over here in disaster area, and here above trend. I'm putting it right there. The likely value of corn in the Corn Belt, the December contract at Chicago, while we're out harvesting, 553, if we have 147 bushels. The price of corn this morning when I looked at the market, 544. This morning when I looked at the market, they were expecting the U.S. yield to be 149 bushels to the acre for corn, at least for that price that goes along with these things. And if you want to write down something today, if the yield for the nation turns out to be trend, 160 bushel, corn will be worth about 455. If it turns out like last year, it'll be up here around $8. If it turns out, like I said, 553. If it's 155 bushels, which is the number the USDA has mentioned most recently, 485. The likely December contract values at harvest time based on what the yields might be. I'm kind of watching pencils here. Before I change this slide. The picture at the bottom showing the ocean temperature if we're having a La Nina. Cold along the equator west of South America, warm north of Australia. That is the ocean condition typical of a La Nina. It's the opposite of that if it's an El Nino. And we pay attention to things like this. And here is what is going on now. This was a week ago. The ocean was cold, and this is this morning up at the top. And the ocean is cold along the equator. That looks like it's moving back toward La Nina. Here's the way it looked in March. It was warm. Now it's gone cold. So the ocean temperature and the indication of air pressure giving us some hint that we're not moving toward the favorable condition for the Corn Belt. If you didn't know what was going to happen back in the time period around 1950 and 60s, you didn't know what the weather was going to be, you would assume that, well, it spends most of its time down here in this blue area, which is La Nina, and just be pessimistic. The chance of being down there is greater than the chance of being up there during those years. And the weather turning bad for the crop when you didn't have any real idea what it was going to do. Then things changed, and we had a good many years that if you didn't know what was going to happen, assume it was going to be good. And you'd be right most of the time. And it appears now we're moving back to the situation of harsher years and tending to go toward the La Nina, or not so favorable for the Midwest. A curious thing, the yields were very, very consistent back in the 1960s. No really good years that went up and hit my dashed line of the potential yield for the state of Iowa. When we have just ideal weather, we'll come up and we'll hit that yield. You see, it's happened a few times. And we don't go above that line. If we ever go above that line, I'll move the line. That is the line of the yield on our very best years. In the 60s and the early 70s, we didn't have any really good crop years and no really bad ones. They were just all consistent. A person came into my office, 1968, and said, "What do you think of our new hybrids?" Yes, he was a seed salesman. I said, "They're just great. Why do you ask?" He said, "Because look how consistent the yields have been. No more of this up and down like we used to have back in the 50s. in the 30s. Now yields are consistent with our new hybrids. We're independent of the weather. I said, do you believe that? Yeah. I couldn't even find him in 1974 when we found out that modern hybrids, with all their great yields, thank you, plant breeders, thank you, plant managers, thank you, plant protection people, all of our modern hybrids, if we have weather that would have cut the yield in half in 1956 and 55, on today's hybrids, it will still cut the yield in half. Yields much higher. But it isn't how high the yields are that determines how much wealth we have in the Corn Belt, is it? We already discussed that. It is the deviation from the trend. And the weather today, if it was the weather that would have cut yield in half in 1950, will cut the yield in half on today's hybrids. Much greater yield. The world won't starve to death. But it will hurt our economy just as much as it would have when we're getting 40 bushels and cut it down to 20, as when we're getting 200 bushels and cut it down to 100. The impact will be the same. And I look at these pictures. A variable time was 25 years. I looked at history as long as we've kept records of corn yield in this country. And this was the third time of high variability. And this was the fourth, and all four of them are 25 years. And this was the third period of consistent yields, 18 years, same as the previous two. And this was the next 18 years. And 2012 was year one of the next 25. When we expect yields to bounce between the dashed line and where we were last year. And risk management become the most important thing in your life. Well, they say, can you make profit when you've got yields doing this in today's world? Yes. Chicago's always made their profit by the volatility. They make it on hour-to-hour volatility, week-to-week, month-to-month. It's hard to compete with them on that. But they're no good at annual volatility. And you are. When the USDA says expect this for a yield, if everything goes well, you've got the field. We're going to be above the USDA. We're going to be below it. You know which side it's going to be on. You know what to do to have that be profitable for you. That is your risk management. If you don't know, find out. Because the people that know may find the next 25 years the most profitable in the generations. And the people that don't know are going to quit farming. What are we doing to help that? Well, at the university level, a farmer came to me and said, you got weather stations? I say, yep. Weather stations tell us the wind and the air temperature and how much water a crop could be using, if it can get it. I said, that's right. That's what they do. We call it potential evapotranspiration. He said, but I read that the amount of yield we actually get is how much water the crop does use compared to how much it could have used. I said, that's right. You take the ratio. Actual water use to potential water use. And that tells you what your crop could be. And all crop forecast models that are any good, that's what they're based on. He said, how can I get that information? I said, go out there and measure your soil every week or two. He says, that's pretty labor intensive. Is there an automatic way? Yeah. We've had that since the 1980s now. We can put a moisture sensor out here under the corn and the soybeans. We'll put one down 1 foot, one down 2 feet, one down 4 or 5 feet. And we'll see how much water the crops are using. And we'll calculate how much water they could have used. And we'll take the ratio and we'll know what the yield could be. Better than we've ever known it before, and we'll know how much water's left in the soil. That will help us with our management. The farmer said, how much does a weather station like that cost? I said, by the time you buy it, install it, get it working, it'll be $12,000. He said, whoa, that's expensive. I said, that is farm equipment. He said, that's relatively cheap. And he got out his checkbook and he said, Why don't you buy one of those for the university and install it somewhere around here and let me see how it works? There it is. It's not on his farm. He didn't want it on his farm. It's on some university-owned land near his farm. This is about 12 miles north of Cherokee, Iowa. And we measured the moisture in the soil under the soybeans this year, corn last year. And now there's 24 of these stations. The co-ops are buying them. Farmers are buying them. Seed companies are buying them. They say, we'll put them up around our places. We'll send all the information into the network, and everyone will know. We'll be ahead of this game for this next 25 years. When it rains down 1 foot, we'll see here's the moisture in the soil, and they get an inch of rain, and it gets down 1 foot, and there's more moisture in the soil. We get another inch of rain, and there's more moisture in the soil, more than it can hold, so it drains down. And we get another rain, and it's more than it can hold, and it drains down. It drained down here to 2 foot depth. Now it's starting to get wet and come up. And we can tell the moisture in the soil as it goes along. We'll try to keep the things we can do, helping those of us that are trying to manage the risk of an increasingly volatile climate for the next 25 years. It will probably include the harshest year of the century. Curiously, the harshest years of the century are about 89 years apart over the last 800 years, according to tree rings. The harshest year for crops in Iowa in the 1800s was 1847. The harshest year for crops in Iowa in the 1900s was 1936. The harshest year for crops in Iowa in the 2000s. Go back to the 1800s. 47, 36, 25. Likely the harshest year. If the weather keeps doing what it's done for 800 years, it'll be around 2025. In summary, we've got a hurricane season just starting, expected to be on the harsh side of usual. Drought likely to persist in the western part of the Corn Belt. Temperature high and low, both being significant and both being more extreme than usual. And climate likely increasingly erratic during the next 25 years. Manage your risk. That's the way we live through the volatile weather. Thank you very much for inviting me to be with you.